What's good, everybody? Welcome to Origin Story, the podcast that interviews creators about where they came from to understand how they got here. My name is Philip Russell, and I am with my co-host,
Ben Thorpe.
And Ben, this week we have Sam Barlow, who is the writer and director of the new game Immortality, as well as Telling Lies and Her Story. And he's the founder of Half Mermaid Productions. In his latest game, Immortality, he asks players to comb through footage from three unreleased movies to uncover what happened to an actress named Marissa Marcel. Damn, this was a really cool conversation because Sam has been making these kind of like FMV or full motion video kind of like movie games for the last, you know, decade or like half decade. And they've kind of always been on my radar, but I've never really played any of them. So Immortality was a great kind of introduction into this, I would say almost this new remixed genre that he's working in. And it was really interesting talking to him about like, what even is a video game, you know?
Yeah, 100%. And I think like we're both gently, I wouldn't say hardcore, but like gently movie people too. And so I think in a lot of ways, this is like right at the corner of both of our interests here in understanding like, all right, well, you can watch a movie, but what does it mean that you can now interact with that movie? And this is also an archive that you're playing with, which is a pretty classic thing that Barlow does. I went back and played Her Story, which also has kind of a video archive that you're kind of playing with to find different clips buried inside of it. And yeah, it's interesting to think about like, well, what is a game and like what is a movie and what does it mean that this is kind of taking place somewhere in between the two of these things? And when we kind of talked to Sam about this, he kind of talked about the idea that, you know, what's most essential in games is, you know, that you've got narrative, but you also have some kind of interactivity and choice, player choice to engage with narrative in some way, which, Phil, I think is interesting for us because we've talked to some of the other creators, games creators, who have taken completely different positions on what is a game.
Yeah. I mean, I think the first one that comes to mind is Greg Kasavin, the creative director of Hades, as well as Braid and, you know, a couple of other titles like Transistor and things like that. And, you know, if you all haven't listened to that episode, check it out. One of the kind of key ideas that Greg talked about that was, I think, really surprising for both of us, given that Hades was such a narrative-driven game, was that to him, essentially, narrative and story is just another tool in the game developer's toolkit in order to make these awesome experiences. And I think that in some ways it's, you know, almost an antithesis to how Sam Barlow, at least in his most recent solo projects, has been approaching game design. And it kind of feels like none of these, you know, Her Story, Telling Lies, or Immortality could exist with that same ethos, you know? So in a lot of ways, I feel like this conversation is really interesting in relation to that Greg Kasavin conversation. And it was one that I think expanded maybe how I view what a game actually is or what a game can be.
Right. I think we both like kind of danced around this question with him about like, well, you know, if this counts as a game, like what else counts as a game? And like, what are other things that you would think of as games? And, you know, another thing that kind of kicked that off is he's someone who is, I think, constantly saying, where's more innovation in this space? We can't keep kind of replicating these old mechanics. Why, you know, how can we push things forward? And if I'm recalling correctly, he also says something to the effect of like, you know, like how close something like scrolling through different kind of Wikipedia entries and kind of the Wikipedia doom scrolling that I do, and I know a lot of people do, as like a kind of game in some ways, which is interesting, again, because I think Immortality in some ways plays with that, that you're clicking on different pictures within kind of a movie clip, and those pictures will take you to other instances of a similar object or a similar actor or a similar emotion on that actor's face, in a way that does in a lot of ways kind of reflect kind of clicking through Wikipedia hyperlinks, right?
Yeah, I think that's like a perfect summation of the experience that you have when you're playing Immortality, and then like with the different flavors, how you play her story and telling lies. And, you know, in this conversation, we get into, you know, how Sam kind of came up with this concept, why he's kind of allured to like these FMV style games. And, you know, yeah, we really dig into kind of like his whole idea around narrative and how it's an essential component to the types of experience he's making that are kind of expanding the genre or the medium in some ways. So how about we just jump right into the conversation, and we will talk more about everything that occurred in the outro. Sam Barlow is the writer and director of Immortality, Telling Lies, and Her Story, and the founder of the Half Mermaid Production Company. His most recent games are interactive fiction experiences that allow players to search through archives of footage, such as a police interrogation or video calls. And Sam's most recent game, Immortality, asks players to comb through footage from three unreleased movies to uncover what happened to the actress named Marissa Marcel. Sam, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Excited to be here.
So I think we just wanted to start off with kind of getting how you're feeling, you know, now that Immortality is out. You know, from my understanding, you know, the reception has been like really, really positive. It got like a 10 out of 10 from Edge Magazine, which is pretty rare for them. And then we even recently saw that RogerEbert.com, which as far as we know, hasn't covered or reviewed video games before, you know, kind of had a really glowing review of the project. So, you know, like, how are you feeling now that this thing is out there?
Yeah, the reception's been fantastic. Because especially with this one, usually I'm always kind of pushing myself to make something that is usually quite specific, right? Like when I went independent and made Her Story, part of the kind of idea there was, well, I'm just going to go and make something that is no one else would, you know, let me make. And so I'll just follow my guts. And if I end up liking it, then maybe there'll be some people out there that like it. And so there's always an understanding of like, this is not for everybody, right? This is not a big crowd pleasing mainstream thing. But yeah, the reception. So, you know, with Immortality, I thought we'd go even further this time and it would be, you know, incredibly divisive, but critically, yeah, it was getting incredible reception. And yeah, the Roger Ebert one was the cherry on the cake, because there's obviously a storied history of Roger Ebert versus video games. And all those fun questions that maybe we've moved on from now in terms of, you know, are video games art? So to have that, you know, the Roger Ebert name stamped on it, and have them kind of judge us and acknowledge that we were worthy was a cool moment.
I want to expand on that a little bit more, you know, less from the angle of our video games art, but I think more specifically, like, what is this? Do categorizations matter here to you? This is, you know, Immortality especially, I think, feels like it fits into this world where it's video game, it's movie, it's somewhere, you know, at the meeting place of these two things. And even when I look at your website, I see this mission to create authored player-centric stories across a spectrum of narrative genres. That feels like it's not necessarily saying, hey, I'm in the business of making video games. And so how do you think about, like, what it is that you're doing?
I mean, I think at this point, the word game, I'm kind of just used to, right? It's my definition of game is so broad, right? If you're being entertained and it's on some kind of computing device, and if you don't do anything, nothing happens, then it's probably a game, right? So that, I remember, was it the Black Mirror guy, Charlie Brooker, did a top 100 video games of all time show a few years back, and he kind of annoyed some people. by pronouncing the number one video game of all time was Twitter. Right, so I think there's, you know, there's a very fluid understanding now of like, oh crap, actually so much of what we do is interactive on either a surface level or on a deeper level. And you know, I get very excited when I see there being some kind of cultural equivalency. So you know, it's very early days, but like when you see Netflix games and when they kind of presented that to us, and the pitch was, well, you'll have your TV and your movies and your games all on the same page. Like you're not going to a separate tab. You're not having to, you know, go to a different device or whatever. It's like, it's all that. It's all like, these are ways in which you can experience stories. And, you know, technically we're calling this one a game and we're calling this one a TV show, right? Or, I mean, that's becoming even more fluid now. It's like, is it a movie? Is it a TV show? If it's an hour and a half long, is it a movie? If it's, you know, 90 minutes, 3 hours, whatever, it's getting very fluid. But, you know, I think definitely, you know, and I'm someone that has a huge love of movies and books and all sorts of different mediums. And I'm definitely coming from a place here of, like, we're tackling this problem from the game side of things, which I think is partly, a lot of it's like business case and tech, right? It's like, if I want to make something like Immortality, I probably need a game engine. Mm. I probably need a device and an audience that's familiar with the device so that you can interact with it in some way. And then when I need to actually make my money back at the end of the day, like, how am I doing that, right? Like, so, you know, when you call it a game, people understand, well, I have to pick up a controller or I have to sit at my computer. They understand, well, I'm used to paying like $20 for something like this on Steam. So you kind of have a business case. So I think it's, but it is strange, right? Like to put something like Immortality out there and look at the top 10 that it's in and you're like, oh, we're going toe to toe with, you know, this pixel art roguelike and there's this RTS thing and there's, you know, whatever the Valorant or something, right? Whatever the big shooter is. It's very strange that it's still like the games ecosystem, it's still kind of a big model, right? Like when I grew up playing games, I pretty much, when I had like my 8-bit home computer, I would play every game that came out, whether I had to like borrow it off a friend or whatever. But, you know, I didn't really care about the genre because I was really into video games. So I was just playing all the video games. Obviously, there are now so many video games, you can't do that. And as well, like, as the medium has kind of become more interesting and complex and rich, you can now define yourself in the same way that, you know, someone said, do you want to come watch a movie? I'd be like, well, what type of movie? Like, I'm not just going to watch any movie, right? So it's, you know, it's still weird sometimes that, you know, the way games are packaged and branded can kind of veer to the kind of capital G gamer kind of aesthetic. But you know, I mean people keep expecting that at some point there's going to be a kind of tipping point where TV and games and whatever's happening on our television will become beautifully enmeshed with, you know, and it's kind of happened as consoles have moved into the living room. And then when we started watching Netflix on our consoles, obviously you're starting to kind of merge the worlds. But, you know, I mean, to the Charlie Rooker joke, I find myself, if I'm watching Netflix and you know, if the rest of my family are out of town and it's like, oh, I get a whole evening to myself, I'm going to sit down, what am I going to watch? I'm going to watch something I couldn't normally watch, and I'll boot up Netflix. And then before I know it, I've wasted 45 minutes just going through Netflix, right? Looking at stuff, because it's kind of a slightly sticky, fun experience to browse that catalog and have it be personalized and suggest stuff and throw you all the thumbnails and everything. So, you know, I think we're so used to that level of kind of interactivity now everywhere that I think at some point, you know, we're going to have this full-on meeting between all the different mediums, and we'll, you know, stop having to worry too much about whether a thing's a game or not. But, you know, as it is right now, there is still, you know, questions of discoverability and hardware and all these kind of things.
Yeah. I'm really in love with, you know, the kind of archive or database nature of your games. I think I'm someone kind of growing up as a kid, I remember going to the public library and you could search through old reels of newspapers. And that kind of interaction, I think, has always felt weirdly intimate. And I think, like, allows for this feeling, even when it's something that is in the public record, that feels, you know, as though it's very personal and as though that information is only there for you and you alone. But I'm wondering if you can talk about, like, what attracts you to the idea of an archive or a database as a site for so many of the games that you've made.
I mean, I think it came from... So certainly when I was younger, the stuff I was really deeply into was a lot of the kind of more avant-garde writing and surrealism and kind of modern art. And a lot of those people were looking at traditional forms of painting or of storytelling and were starting to break them down and deconstruct them and were saying, well, you know, in the 20th century, you know, everything is so much more fractured and the way we consume and kind of absorb information is now so disparate and hyperlinked that we're going to create art forms that reflect that. So I was definitely, like, that was the thing growing up. You know, I remember being really into Bowie and then Bowie getting me into William Burroughs and cut-up technique. And there's a bunch of kind of early stuff that J.G. Ballard wrote, including his book, The Atrocity Exhibition, which is, you know, it's a book, so it is technically linear. But in the foreword, he encourages you to read it by just kind of flicking through the pages and dropping in. And if you see like a word or phrase that looks interesting to you, just drop in, read that paragraph, pull out, and kind of just, you know, so it's very, very early primitive hyperlinking almost. But so, you know, that was always something I had a taste for, like the texture of it. And then kind of when I did Her Story, I'd been working on more traditional games. I'd done a couple of Silent Hill games where we're kind of doing interesting things with the storytelling. And I think I got to the point where I was painfully aware that a lot of the assumptions we make with a traditional video game, a lot of the things that we kind of take for granted, I started to worry that they were kind of props that we were leaning on. So kind of before I professionally joined games, I was really, really into like the immersive sims, like kind of Thief, System Shock, Deus Ex, like those were my games back in the day. And then after that, I kind of got really into Nintendo. And so particularly stuff like Zelda, some of the Metroid games, like just that level of immersion and exploration, that sense of like physical presence in a game world. These were things that I was like really, really into. And when we made Silent Hill Shattered Memories, that was kind of my love letter to that idea. So we tried to make this game that was extremely immersive, and we kind of removed a lot of the things that might get in the way of that. Tried to create a game world that you could just kind of move through kind of seamlessly. But after that, I kind of really started to think about it and question that you get so much for free just by dropping someone in a 3D environment, right? It's just naturally enjoyable as a human to explore and to kind of walk around places. And, you know, a lot of the games that at that time were held up for storytelling, I would kind of look at them and I'd be like, well, you get a lot of like atmosphere from the 3D exploration. Everyone was very hot on environmental storytelling. But still, to actually tell a story, these games would have to drop in like tape recorders or diary pages, right? To actually tell a story. And they were always really struggling with characters because the characters are really hard to do. And so, you know, even if you have infinite money, right, the Bioshock games, most of the characters are dead or behind screens or inaccessible. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to tell those character-based stories, you're having to listen to voice recordings or kind of pre-canned cutscenes. And then when you get to kind of indie games like Gone Home, where you literally can't afford to have 3D characters walking around in a scene, they were still having to put in some voice acting, right? They were having to pull in voice acting to communicate a level of emotion. So I was at that point kind of really starting to think, like, you know, if the most extreme and maybe slightly reductive point would be that if I looked at what moved me when I played Gone Home, it was listening to the voiceovers that would play when you found diary pages. And, you know, I was like, well, if someone edited that into a radio play, it would probably still have a fairly similar narrative experience, despite mm-hmm. the fact that all of the game stuff is extremely compelling and fun. So with her story, I kind of pushed myself to, you know, I wrote this very pretentious manifesto. It's like, I'm going to make a game with no 3D exploration. And moreover, one of the big things for me was no meaningful state changes. So, you know, a lot of when you talk about video games, and for me, when I was really into those immersive sims, and you talk about what's special about video games, I find you talk a lot about simulation, right? Like, that all the stuff that is the most video gamey stuff comes down to simulation, right? Shooters are straightforward because it's very easy for us to simulate bullets and guns and physics and explosions. You know, driving games is very easy for us to simulate cars and motion. So these are things that feel intrinsically very video gamey. And so I was like, well, what does it mean to tell an interactive story and to create something that's deeply immersive and intimate without these things, right? So I'm not moving through a 3D space. There's no simulation. Partly, I'm going on a lot for this question, but partly I remember there was a moment where it was when Half-Life 2 came out. Maybe it was not immediately after it came out, but it was whenever I was playing it, and I just had a son, and I remember playing Half-Life 2, and everybody was raving about like the physics system in that game, and oh, there's these great puzzles where you have to do stuff with physics, and I was like slightly cynical. Because as a hardcore Zelda fan, I was like, these are kind of the same puzzles as Zelda. It's just they're using physics rather than like specific scripting. But I remember doing this one puzzle that involved stacking some things and knocking them over or something. And I looked over and my son was playing with his blocks, right? And I was like, oh my God, we're both doing the same thing. And I was like, you know, clearly, as a human being, it is extremely enjoyable. There's endorphins and everything. To play with this simulation, right? To test the rules of things, to experiment and to be playful. And, you know, but then I was like, but as someone that really cares about story and character, how much of that is plugging directly into the storytelling? So that was, you know, with her story was this idea, okay, I'm going to try and make a game that still feels intimate, still feels expressive, still feels like challenging, but doesn't have any meaningful state change. You know, so it's, you know, you think of like narrative as well. The thing people always go to is like branching narrative. Choose your own adventure. Oh, I didn't save Bob. So in chapter 3, Bob's wife is going to hate me, right? Like that is so intrinsic to people's, when you try and justify why is an interactive story interesting, it so often comes back to that idea of there being some explicit consequence. So with, you know, with that, I kind of set myself those rules and I knew kind of I wanted to do something in the police procedural mystery space because that had been something I'd pitched publishers a lot and they would always say, yeah, we get it, Sam, these things are huge in every other medium but they don't work in games, right? Like games have to be about action and you have to be a powerful, empowering individual, like, you know, these are not the kind of stories that work in games. So I was like, well, I'm going to show you. And one of the big exciting things with her story was I gave myself, although I didn't have a huge amount of time or money, I gave myself at least half of the development time up front to just research and explore and think about stuff before I was going to even touch a computer and do any of the work, which is a luxury I had never really gotten in making the bigger, kind of more traditional video games. So part of that was going, okay, I want to tell this story, something in this space. You know, how does this genre work? What is interesting and exciting about this genre? How do these stories normally work? I you know, did a ton of research into, like, well, how does a homicide detective go about interrogating a suspect? All these kind of questions. And I think early on, I decided the interview room was going to be the focus for the game, which was partly because that was, like, my favorite show growing up was Homicide: Life on the Street. The best bits of that show were when they were in the interrogation room. Just, like, a lot of my favorite kind of mysteries and police things would always kind of peak in that kind of, you know, showdown between the detective and the suspect. So I was thinking, well, that's a really interesting thing. It's going to be very convenient for me as an indie developer because I don't need to do the car chases and the cities and all the stuff LA Noire did, right? I'm just going to focus on this. And by focusing on something that is the most kind of human part of it, I do have, like, the indie advantage because, you know, that kind of human interactions, conversations is still a thing that no one has solved and that, you know, people, you know, have not been able to crack. So if I can come at it from a different angle, then that would be interesting. So I was kind of exploring all this, and part of that exploration was discovering at that point, it was like just before the true crime explosion, and really, like, video was just becoming kind of ubiquitous. Like, our phones were getting good enough, our internet connections were getting good enough that everyone was now watching lots of YouTube, right, uploading Vines, and, you know, video just suddenly started to be everywhere and feel different. And I was discovering all of these real life interrogation clips that were uploaded in the public interest. So I was watching a lot of those, reading a lot of the transcripts as part of my research. And so really kind of all those disparate things, right? Like this love of avant-garde storytelling, these desires to move away from kind of traditional game mechanics, watching all of this footage, reading about the processes around police interrogations, how the recordings are used, etc. It all kind of, you know, welled up. And then I remember, you know, I woke up one day and it's like, oh, what if the game was a police database and you have all these clips and you could search and you know, it was like I'd been kind of active in the kind of text adventure interactive fiction space for a very, you know, at the end of the 90s, was really into that genre. And, you know, that's a genre where the promise is that you can type anything, right? The game will just have a prompt and you can type something and then the story will follow your lead. But if you've played those games, you know that actually, like, the parser is not that sophisticated. There's only so many things you can type. So there's always this clash between the magic of the blank prompt and the reality of it. And so, you know, even as this idea occurred to me, I was like, well, this is kind of cool. It, like, has some of that magic of the text adventure where, you know, and the people that were still making text adventures would justify it by pointing to probably 5 or 6 examples in games where you would get halfway through a game and you would suddenly think, oh shit, what if I try this? What if I type this and it would work and you'd have this magical moment? But the, you know, the detractors would say, well, yeah, that's happened 5 times. It, you know, the rest of playing these games is go east, go west. You know, I can't do that. I don't understand this word. So when this idea occurred to me, I was like, oh, well, I get some of that magic, right? Like, people can play Her Story and I think of an idea that's not being presented to them by the text, be like, oh, is this what happened? Have an idea and come up with a word to type and then discover something magical. But because you get that this is a crappy old piece of technology, this police database, you don't have the expectation that every single thing you type should magically work. So, you know, a lot of this stuff all kind of came together. And you know, that, you know, that became Her Story, and kind of a lot of, there wasn't much, I don't think there was, I can't really remember, but there wasn't as much kind of conscious, like, this is what I'm doing at every step of it. It was always like, this sounds like an exciting idea. This feels like a cool thing to do. I'll just kind of follow this. And then kind of after Her Story, looking back at it, then I was kind of more consciously thinking about, well, what have I just done? And that's when I started to really dig this idea that what I'd done was to take a lot of my favorite verbs from those traditional games, you know, exploring, building a mental map of a level or a planet, accessing new areas through gaining keys or kind of knowledge or abilities, and realizing that I'd taken all that good stuff but applied it directly to the story or the video content, right? So you're discovering new clips in the way that you might discover new rooms in Metroid. And as you discover more and more clips, you're kind of building this map of the whole story. And by revisiting certain clips with new information, you're unlocking layers of those clips. You know, so I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting that it's very much in the tradition of these games I loved. But, you know, coming in from a very different way. And I think that was... I mean, again, it was a conscious choice. I was there saying this will not be systemic. There'll be no 3D exploration. And then somehow, you know, you end up replicating what's good about those systemic 3D exploration games, but in a way that's really addressing the story. So I think that was, at the time, quite a novel approach. Because, like I say, so much, you know, the expectation with narrative games really was either you'd have a narrative game with very little gameplay that would be very linear, right? But you'd experience a story. Or it would be kind of very systemic, very choice-based. And so this was like an interesting sort of third way.
Her story is a narrative Metroidvania.
Yes. Yeah, I've used that line.
Well, you know, I think that that's interesting. So recently we talked to Graham Parks, who was the writer and creative director of this indie game called Before Your Eyes. You know, in that game, the narrative allows the player to move through scenes, time and space through the blinking of their eyes, which is tracked through the webcam. And, you know, something that we found pretty intriguing that we talked to Graham about was, you know, when you have that kind of mechanic baked into how you're presenting your narrative, it kind of incorporates this interesting friction in terms of storytelling, where like you have the story you're trying to tell, and then you have this player agency that kind of has at least some say in terms of what is going to be seen in each individual scene and how they're going to experience the narrative in any given scene because of, you know, the eye blinking. And I think, you know, your most recent games that use FMV, it kind of feels like it takes that concept to the extreme, right? Where I feel like I look at, when I played Immortality, I was just constantly thinking, I mean, it seems as if everybody would have a completely different experience in terms of how they come to the conclusions that they do because of the different clips that they see and how they get to those different clips. So, you know, I think Ben and I are both really curious with all three of these games, just like, how the hell do you even approach, you know, constructing these narratives, because there's so much agency in terms of, you know, how the player is going to, you know, see X scene. And yeah, I guess like, how are you approaching that? And maybe Immortality, since that's the newest one, like let's talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a choice. There are a lot of video games that talk about freedom, but I think there are two ways of doing it. One is let's pick on Half-Life again. Like it's the Half-Life way where, yeah, you go anywhere you want, do anything you want, but we're going to place lights and steer the walls of this level so that you will subconsciously head for this doorway. Oh, we're going to have a monster run out of this doorway, so you'll run to the left, right? There's so much work that goes into kind of stage managing so that you feel like you're in charge, you feel like you have agency, but you don't, because they want to present a very specific set of beats. And then there is the genuine freedom, which I think like I bore people by going on about Zelda Breath of the Wild. Like I think it's so funny that there are countless open world games, right? And there are whole companies like Ubisoft that put out almost nothing but these open world games. But really it was only when I played Zelda Breath of the Wild where I was like, oh, this is actually an open world game. Like this is a game where they genuinely want me to do what I, you know, they're like, go anywhere, and they mean it, right? It's not just a way of spreading mission markers around an island or something. And I think what makes Zelda work for me as well is that there's an inherent joy in walking through the grass climbing up a mountain because you saw a little tree over here, right? That in itself is inherently joyful. They care about the walking through the world part of the open world games. And so I think, you know, with these games, there is an inherent, like, you've got to find the game feel, and the content itself is not filler, right? Like, that's like the craziest production headache with something like Immortality, because, you know, there's a generosity to the game, which I think is also absolutely essential. I think Zelda has this, right? If you're going to say to a player who might be confused and like have like choice anxiety, because it's like, I could go anywhere, I could do anything. Well, what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to play this game, right? Like, that's you're asking a lot of the player when you do that. So I think what you have to do, and I think Nintendo does this in all their games, is give something back. And what you give back is saying, well, we're going to be generous. There's just an abundance of fun, cool shit in this game, right? It's going to be a joyful, fun thing. So with Immortality, you know, there's no, like, you know, there's no cut and paste content like you would find in a bad open world game, right? There's just tons of stuff for you to discover. And that in itself should inherently be joyful, right? So we put so much effort into the aesthetics of things, of like each individual scene having something to it, right? Being in itself interesting. So the worst version of Immortality, if nothing worked, would just be someone throwing a bunch of random interesting things at you and you'd be like, oh, shiny. But then I think what really is, and this is kind of the stuff that I've built up over the course of the three games, is this idea that the audience is really, really smart, which in itself is a controversial position to take in video games. The audience is really smart. The audience has seen and experienced more stories in their lifetime than, you know, if you went back 200, 300 years, people just wouldn't, right? Even an aristocrat sat in his house with his grand library is not as exposed to as many stories as somebody who's logging into Twitter every day, hearing the news, reading graphic novels, playing video games, streaming the latest Netflix show. Like, so everyone's like really smart and everybody gets the tropes. And, you know, it's, I think part of the reason we have all these kind of movie sims is people are just so used to this stuff now that it's easier for them to pick holes and to kind of go, oh, I've seen this before. Oh, there's a plot hole there. So you have an audience that's like super smart. And so that's kind of almost the rationale of something like Her Story was going, well, if you tell a traditional linear story to an audience that knows every story, it's really hard because you're trying to outsmart them constantly. So the idea here was, well, no, let's let them be smart. So by giving them, you know, pieces of the story, you're almost inviting them closer to kind of the experience of being the creator, of being involved in putting this thing together. And kind of the trick is that each individual piece has multiple layers. So all these stories that I'm telling, you know, they could theoretically be told as linear stories with a main character and some side characters and various things happening. But I get excited by stories that sprawl a bit more, right? Become slightly more novelistic. And so what we're doing here is we're telling these stories that have a bunch of different things going on, several layers. So in the case of Immortality, there's a silly amount of layers going on. We have three actual movies with actual stories. And so, you know, someone might want to put the pieces together to figure out the stories of the movies. Then we have the fact that we're also showing you how these movies were made. So now you have kind of the behind the scenes stuff that is going on, which, you know, is a more sophisticated ask of the audience because you're having to pick up on the subtext and you're having to put two pieces together by saying, well, this happened and why was this person upset here? What happened in the previous thing they filmed? And because you shoot movies not in linear order, you know, both these stories that overlaid are not running in parallel. They're kind of coming at it from different angles. And then there's like the bigger picture story of like, well, what happened to Marissa Marcel? What's the deal with this character, Marissa Marcel? And then there may be some other layers as well, without spoiling anything. So the really exciting thing is, like, when you're writing these things, there's like a, it's not simple, but there's kind of a simple checklist where you go, well, this individual piece here, does it, and then what, in a very mechanical way, I'll often do is I'll know what the themes are of the stories. I'll know what each individual character's story is. You know, what are the big questions? What are their big conflicts or desires or whatever? And each scene should address every single one of those things in some meaningful way. And in the case of Immortality, there's extra things, right? Of like, well, each scene should have one piece of movie craft, right? Each scene should have one little thing that's like, gives you an insight into how movies are made, how things play out differently. And so what happens then is a completely different player, you know, one player might come in and be like, well, I'm really digging this character. I want to know what happened to the actor Carl Greenwood. So I'm kind of following this thread. Someone else might be like, well, I just want to know what happens in the fictional movie Minsky. Someone else might be like, really trying to figure out what's the deal with the director, John Durek. And someone else might be just enjoying absorbing, like, well, how did they make movies in 1970? And how is that different to when they made movies in the studio system, right? And you could put different pieces together. And if you're putting pieces together that have Carl in them, you're now making something that looks like a story, right? In by tracking Carl. And so, you know, you're kind of letting people... and you know, this is what humans do. Like, humans love to see patterns. People love to organize things, right? Like, so this is kind of narrative Tetris. You're letting people put these things together. And I think really when people freak out and like, how does this even work? Like, how could you tell a story like this? I think they're usually thinking about plot, right? Because that's what we normally think of as how a story is told. Well, you have to have A and then B and then C. If you don't, then how does the plot work? And really, to me, like, the plot is the least interesting thing. And really, plot is just how do you organize the information? And, you know, we all know that actually there are many ways of doing that, right? You could go watch Pulp Fiction, in which Tarantino puts things out of order so that it's sadder, right? Because you see this guy die, and then now you see it before he was dead, and it's, like, sad. And you have that extra layer of dramatic irony. But you could equally tell that story, you know, in complete chronological order. It would be about the same character. It might make you feel slightly differently and maybe have a, you know, slightly different message. But there are so many different ways you can organize these pieces. And so actually plot is the most arbitrary thing, right? And so giving over the ability to organize and kind of create the plot to some extent to the audience feels like a reasonable thing. And it's quite interesting to watch people play as well, because there's kind of an element of self-pacing as well, where I mean it's slightly less, you can't be quite as explicit in steering things in Immortality, although there are kind of ways. But you know, if somebody is, you know, has had lots of very exciting fun things that they've discovered and they've put things together and light bulbs have gone off, they're maybe then in a position to just noodle around, or maybe they're in the mood to just noodle around and have the side character or pick up on some atmospheric details. But if they get to the point where they want to move on now, right, they're ready to move on, then they can go back to that clip where the really exciting thing happened, or they're like, oh, I'm going to go click on this character again because I know that character's at the heart of things, right? So there's an element where there is this ability for players to kind of steer things themselves. So, you know, for me, it's, you know, there aren't that many downsides, because it's really about having a different kind of conception of this, of like, well, I want to share these stories and themes and ideas with the audience, and I'm giving that to them in the way that a sculptor might, or even like a painting, right? If you go and see a painting in an art gallery, you sit down and you absorb it, and no one's telling you where to put your eye. You know, it's a slightly loose example, but you know, so it's that kind of presentation of giving you something that is more exploratory, and then like the huge bonus is for the person playing it, you then have this much closer, more intimate relationship to the story. And so much of it is happening in your brain, which to me is like a real fundamental of if it's an interactive experience, if it's a game. So if the point is this thing is cool because I'm participating in it, you want as much happening in someone's brain as possible, right? Like that's where the cool shit is happening. And there is this kind of common understanding that, you know, if you're trying to tell a story in Halo, if someone is running through a battlefield on multiple height levels, deciding which gun to use, managing their ammo count, prioritizing who to shoot first, which piece of cover to use, like there's very little of their brain left to start emotionally responding to things, to be thinking about and anticipating elements of the plot and story. And so kind of the trick with my games has been to reduce as much as possible that kind of, you know, that mechanical use of your brain to do the kind of the gamey stuff, but to still massively use your brain, right? It's just now it's all questions and mechanics which are fixated on the story itself. So it becomes like, you know, it's really what I'm trying to do is encourage people to be as obsessive about things as I am, right? I'm like to be, and you know, immortality, it really literally is saying, this is what it's like to be obsessive about movies. You go watch a movie and you watch it 10 times and you pause it and you freeze frame it and you note the mise-en-scene and you then go read that autobiography of the director and then you go read the biography written by someone else about actually how the director was lying about everything, right? And you know, that's exciting to have that level of kind of scrutiny, and to then, you know, be in the edit room with the editor and just be scrutinizing the footage and appreciating, you know, the kind of frame by frame expressions on people's faces. Really, you know, immortality is like, well, let's take all that stuff and that's the game.
I totally hear you on the level of, as a player, it's really engaging to be able to start to draw the little lines together and start to build the map in your head. But I was also thinking about, like, how on earth did you engage with this as a director working with actors, and how linear were things on set, and how did you move people through scenes? I mean, you know, when you were filming the three movies, were those done in a linear fashion, or were you doing, you know, in the same way that we have these match cuts to completely random scenes? How did you engage with that? And you know, did you mirror, you know, the work on set of this kind of jumping from scene to scene to scene, or were things done in a kind of more complete linear way?
Yeah, when we shoot these things, I always try, then it's just about the actors, right? It's about helping them. Because if you're saying, like, the fun of this is to scrutinize someone's face and through the subtext, right, get something out of it, then you need to give the actors as much, you know, freedom and support as possible. So, I mean, and it's you know, it's never possible to shoot everything in chronological order because of practicalities, but it's always trying to get as close as possible. So in the case of Immortality, you know, the three movies were entirely separate shoots. We try and shoot everything through so there is a linear progression through the story, so that, you know, if, you know, the thing that is the most deeply buried is, you know, this so-and-so's relationship with so-and-so, or is this the thing's going to happen on set that's then going to color other things, then, you know, because the actors have so much going on, so many lines to remember, so many different contexts, that you know, at least having the, you know, give them that through line, you know, is pretty useful.
Yeah, I'm thinking, like, just about your games in general, and, you know, you recently had a tweet that kind of influenced maybe this question. You were talking about, well, let's read it. You said, there are so many possibilities for what games could be that when I see a company throw money at what apparently is a pretty specific clone of another game, it feels like a bum note. Maybe in olden times it was okay to be like, this is a genre now, but I feel like we can do better. And, you know, something I was thinking about with your games is that I think it's pretty fair to say that you're interested in expanding the medium of what a game is. And to me, I think, you know, I'm a writer, and I think usually what I think of that, I feel like form is where a lot of that expansion takes place in whatever kind of art form. And I think we're in this really strange time, specifically in the games industry, where it kind of feels like everything's slowly kind of imploding as budgets kind of continue to skyrocket to make these things. And I'm curious, like, I don't know, just like, how are you feeling about the state of the industry in relation to, like kind of broadening the scope of what games could be? Because I feel like, you know, just listening to you talk in this conversation so far, it's firing off so many receptors into my brain of like, what is a game? And like, maybe I think I have a fairly broad understanding of what games could be, but even now I'm like, oh, maybe I'm still even being a bit closeted in terms of what I think a game is. So that's kind of a wishy-washy question, but maybe just to reiterate it, like, yeah, how are you feeling about the state of things? And do you feel like there's more opportunities for things like Immortality to be made? Or does it feel kind of like, damn, each time you make one of these, it feels like a miracle?
It's probably jumping between the extremes, depending on what is happening on that day. You know, I think sometimes you sit through like the big game showcases and you're like, oh my God, there's 20 of the same game. Mm-hmm. And, I like the as a storyteller, the thing that always gets to me is like the repetition of characters, right? There's such a limited set of characters and situations that you can explore in a game so often because we're so tied to these very rigid genres. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, there's just so much more being made now. The ease to get to market is so much greater that... And, you know, there's no one in charge of the industry, right? So it's not like I can usefully disagree with, like, the direction of the entire industry. And you know, there are definitely things that are sad, right, where you look at what's happened to phone gaming. And it kind of pretty much feels like the last 2 years they've killed phone gaming, right? I think, like, the arrival of Apple Arcade, there was, a number of changes to the store. And then Apple Arcade coming along and essentially fencing off premium games within a kind of PG banner pretty much destroyed the idea of making premium games on mobile as a meaningful thing. And that's really sad because mobile gaming was so exciting because everyone had phones. And, you know, the types of control systems we had on phones were suddenly fresh and new. And there was touchscreen gaming and using cameras. And the fact that this is a very intimate personal device was like super exciting. But it, you know, business decisions and capitalism have kind of killed that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's things like that where you're just like, ah, feels like we're in the sucky reality, right? There's an alternate universe where phone gaming continued to go in interesting places. But, you know, I think unless there is a big apocalypse, like inevitably the future of entertainment and storytelling is digital, right? It is going to be on devices. Exactly what that looks like, no one knows. And so, yeah, I've been coming at this from the game side. You know, maybe at some point it stops being as explicitly, you know, linked to the game side. So, you know, I think we'll continue to see cool things. I mean, the fact that, you know, it's easy to forget, but if I think back to when I made Silent Hill Shattered Memories, like the arguments I had to make to justify the fact that that game didn't have a combat system, the fact that we wanted to tell a story that was about complicated grief, you know, there were so many decisions we made that, you know, we just had to fight for every inch to justify that this medium should be allowed to do these things. And now I can just decide to make Immortality, and it is scary, it is risky, and, you know, maybe I'll make a bet and lose all my money one day, but, you know, I think that in itself is quite exciting. And you know, as part of a larger societal people, you know, becoming accustomed to video games and digital things. So, you know, who knows? I remember someone telling me, it's when the pandemic was, early days of the pandemic, and they said it was exciting. They were coming at it from a very high level business perspective. They were saying it's very exciting because you're going to have a generation of kids that spent two years just sat on computers. And so the innovations that would have taken 5-10 years to happen are going to happen a lot sooner because these kids have just become so much more immersed and entrenched in gaming and accelerated. So this younger generation that is going to, you know, invent new things and change things will be kind of much, much more ahead of the curve. So who knows?
I wanted to kind of, your games to me, I think, really care very deeply about making the player, like, meta awareness of the game, that they are playing a game. You know, I'm thinking about, you know, Immortality does it, but, you know, also something like Her Story, when you have the flickering screen and you see your silhouette. Why is that important? Why is that an important element of the stories that you're telling, to make players feel like they are part of, and in some ways complicit in, the stories that you're kind of unspooling?
I think it's inherent. I think it can be really useful to establish some kind of frame anyway. So you kind of, you know, you're kind of limiting the possibilities, especially if someone's interacting, you're kind of almost kind of helping them understand the kind of constraints is part of it. I think there is a really useful storytelling thing. And this is something that I kind of learned from Hitchcock, was, and again, sort of mirrors this disillusionment with the ultimate immersion of these kind of immersive VR type games, was, you know, if you look at what someone like Hitchcock does, it's all about creating this extreme immersion. And you know, when people watch a movie and are terrified, or, you know, the suspense is kicking in and they're genuinely anxious about what's happening on screen, like, you're clearly having them plug into the story and believing in the fakeness, you know, going beyond the fakeness to the point where they can perspire or be terrified, right? But what you see when you look at Hitchcock is he will always punctuate these things. He might throw in some humor, or a particularly like a particular piece of camera work or something, which almost calls attention to itself. And rather than diminish the immersion, like, I think there's, when you're immersed in something and you're kind of committing to it, having it push back a bit can oftentimes be quite useful, because I think having that pushback, it almost makes you push back twice as hard. Whereas I think if you're getting rid of all of that, then you're leaving it up to the player to poke holes in it, right? So there's an element of sort of attention, of manipulating people's attention. And then I think as well, like, a fundamental aspect of art is the conflict between the detachment and the kind of emotional involvement, right? So what makes going to see a movie different from real life is, so I can't remember, someone uses this example as well, like one of the storytelling guru people, was like, if you walk down the street and you see someone drop down dead in front of you, like, you have the emotional reaction to that in the moment, and it's all emotion and it's all intense. And then a week later, you might think back on it and start thinking about your own mortality and thinking on a very intellectual level about it. But these two things are separate. But if you're going to see a movie about death, you're able to, because you have the distance, you're able to simultaneously be thinking about the idea whilst also experiencing the emotions. And it's this beautiful kind of synthesis that, I think maybe this person got very pretentious and said that, like, that's what we used to call a religious experience. Hmm. We don't have those anymore. So this is, but, you know, it's that, I think there is, I am definitely, like, for me, always conscious of balancing, like, a level of pushback or detachment with then giving people an ability to kind of lean in, which, yeah, I mean, in the case of Immortality, you're going, here are these, all these different levels of fake stories, and you want to be excited and interested and moved by them on all these different levels, but we're reminding you at every step of the way, this is not real, right? This is not real. And these are not people living inside your TV screen. They're little dots of color that, you know, when you pull back and look at them, look like real people. So I think there's definitely, for me, that is definitely my texture, is kind of balancing those things to kind of give you this interesting relationship.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, with Immortality specifically, I kind of felt a lot of, I mean, as you've talked about, it's very densely packed. Like, if anything, one thing I was thinking as I was playing is, like, man, it, the game asks a lot of the player in terms of, like, remembering you know, there's like the, like you said, there's the level of the film, there's the behind the scenes, there's kind of another element that I won't get be too explicit about. And so there's a lot of things you're kind of tracking in addition to like objects on screen, which are using to match cuts. And, you know, I kind of found that it reminded me a lot of like David Lynch's work broadly, where there's kind of so much densely packed into the narrative. And then there's like a macabre kind of mixed with a mundane element to it. That basically when you finish the experience, I found that like the first thing I was immediately going to like YouTube videos and like forum posts. And it almost feels like that game, maybe even more so than something like Her Story. It's like, you kind of are forced to go and like talk to other people and engage with other people, in order to make sense of the experience you just had. And I'm wondering if maybe that is a bit of your ethos with that project, or with these kind of this trilogy of projects in general, where compared to a lot of, I'd say, like more traditional games that give you the typical kind of payoff for the narrative you've experienced by the end, it kind of feels like with this game, which maybe is just a sign of like good art, it kind of forces you to then have to think after the fact of like, what is this experience I just had, and like, I want to talk to other people about this experience that I just had.
Yeah, I mean, that's so important to me. And all the stuff that I love leaves you with something, right? Like, I think if something is neatly, if everything's resolved and explained, then you can kind of wrap a bow around it, put it on the shelf, and move on. And then, like, in 6 months' time, in a year's time, it's gone. And you enjoyed it at the time, right? It was a roller coaster and it was exciting, but you know, the stuff I love is the stuff where you get to the end, maybe there is some catharsis, there is some kind of resolution, but you're then left thinking like, well, what happens next? Or, oh, but why did they do that thing, right? Or you just have something that keeps it alive in your head. And you know, those are the stories I love. I remember talking to, as a showrunner, they almost made a TV series of Her Story. Hmm. And the showrunner they brought on, and he was saying to me, like, I'm so jealous of you, because he was a Hollywood screenwriter, done some pretty big movies. And he was like, as a storyteller, I know that ambiguity and leaving things unresolved is like the magic. Like, that's the stuff that's the best taste. But I have to always resolve things, because I can't upset the audience. And I have to make everyone feel like they got it and resolve things before they step outside the movie theater. And then when he played Her Story, he was like, you kind of get to have your cake and eat it here, because you can deal with levels of ambiguity and questions, because the audience knows that maybe they can keep digging, right? Like, it's not finished. Like, if they want to answer something, maybe they can just keep digging and they'll find an answer. So there's this sense that they have some play in that, so that they feel slightly more comfortable in that interactive space with those kinds of interesting ambiguities that, you know, maybe, you know, when part of the immortality is people looking back at the 70s and going, oh, 70s movies were like this high point. And you watch 70s movies and so many of them just finish, right? They get to a certain point, they just finish, and they'll finish on some ambiguous note, right? Or like a movie like Cruising, you just left on like Al Pacino's face and you're like, what is happening? Was he the killer? Is he happy? Has he found some, is he acknowledged part of, you know, what is going on with this guy, right? Just all these questions. So you can't kind of neatly put that away. So that, yeah, that to me is like really, really key, is, you know, the games, like I love, like we talked about Metroid games, right? There's like a twofold thing with a Metroid game, where a Metroid game doesn't really start until you finish it, right? You'll finish a Metroid game and it'll say 30% completion. And then you have to kind of dig deeper and actually discover this. And suddenly you're like, I just discovered this whole entire hidden part of this planet that I didn't even know existed, right? And there's, and it's a deeper appreciation of the mechanics to access that stuff. But I will, you know, I love the idea that people will play one of my games, get to the point where they feel satisfied and they're done, but they'll know, they'll have this sense that like, oh, if there's a rainy day, I can boot this thing back up again and poodle around. Or like you say, go talk to someone about it and enjoy discussing and getting other people's perspectives on it, kind of enjoy the fact that there are these kind of interesting questions that I have kind of, you know, some investment in.
That's really interesting. I mean, you just kind of answered what I was going to ask next, is like a lot of your games, it kind of feels like they end, but they're, you know, there's still more that you could, that you haven't found yet. And like, what was the reasoning behind that? But I think that like really, that really speaks
it's,
to that.
It's a really hard thing to pull off. Again, like I look at Zelda games and some of the earlier Zelda games, I would struggle with this thing, right? Like you're playing a Zelda game, you just want to explore and have fun. The game's telling you, you've got to go kill Ganon, right? Like you've got 5 hours to kill Ganon. There's lightning in the sky, but I'm like, no, I've got like some subquests. I've got to go do some stuff over here. And at some point, you're like, oh, I should probably kill Ganon now. Go kill Ganon. And then you're like, oh, I've got 12 more golden spiders to find. And often with those games, I would find that getting of the 12 spiders would, I would be kind of, you know, the game would be getting thin and I would be kind of lessening my enjoyment of the game. What I loved, and I don't think I'm able to do this quite, but with Breath of the Wild was, there was so much content that you knew you were never going to find it all. And the game was like, you're never going to find it all, so just relax. Just do the stuff that's interesting to you. To the point where the few people on the internet that did get every single thing discovered that their reward was like a golden piece of poop, right? It was Nintendo going, you're not supposed to do this. Like, just chill. But yeah, that, you know, that to me, that kind of, that idea that the thing is still alive and interesting to you. And with it being an interactive thing, it, you know, genuinely having a level of kind of life to it is definitely key to me.
I had the experience with Her Story where I was like, I've seen a good amount of this. And then I kind of pulled up, you can see what clips you've seen, and then realized I had missed just massive chunks of the game and that they were still kind of out there. One of the questions I wanted to ask you, because it feels like it's at the forefront of immortality, is this question about like, is the art, like, is it worth, is the kind of the suffering that you go through, or in some cases the exploitation that you go through to create a thing, worth it if it's immortalized in a piece of art? You know, in some ways, even if only one person, the viewer, ever really sees it. And that question, I think, jumped out to me just because video games, I think, is an industry. We're seeing, like, every other week, you know, these exposés about working conditions and just how bad things have been behind the scenes for the creation of, you know, X game. And, you know, I'll read those and then sometimes I'll go back and I'll play Red Dead Redemption 2 and I'll be like, it's pretty fun, pretty good. And so I don't know. I wanted to, in some ways, I suspect that immortality is maybe the answer to the question that I'm asking you. But like, where are your feelings on, you know, what's worth it in art and where to draw some of those lines?
Yeah, I mean, it's always, and especially with immortality, there are questions here as well that as a video game maker, you're creating, you know, the video games are a very bad immortality machine because you create these things that maybe in 5 years won't exist on the App Store. Or even if they do survive in 10 years, will have aged so badly, you know, because of the technologies and things. So, you know, Silent Hill Shattered Memories was one of the best things I've made. There are people that love that game, but it's very hard to play now. Like, you'd have to physically track down the right hardware. There aren't that many copies in circulation. And then even if you did that graphically, people's faces would look weird, right? Because you're like, oh, people's faces just look better now. Like, this is weird old school computer faces. So it's really weird to be in video games and to some extent feel like you're a companion to books and movies and things. But I feel like you're aware painfully that we're certainly at the life cycle in video games where our things age out a lot quicker. So you're kind of thinking about those aspects. And again, in video games, you have to work very, very hard to make these things. And it's important to us. And I guess, and I think, you know, for every time you highlight something extremely toxic or horrible about video games, you know, usually it applies to other industries too, right? It's more about capitalism and other, you know, power dynamics within our world than specifically video games. And, you know, sometimes because people are so invested in the art that, you know, you can kind of exploit them more. But I guess, I mean, definitely making immortality you know, it's not like I have an answer that is spelled out in Immortality. Like you say, it's partly about asking the questions. And suddenly going through the making of it and the difficulty of making it almost changed my mind. And then as well, seeing it transformed, you know, you're writing this story that is about an actress, and what does it mean for the actress to be changed by the roles that she's playing? How much of themselves do they put into it? You know, all these questions, and we're putting real actresses through that. So it was very interesting to see the various actors to some extent changing the story in how they told it, especially in kind of how they, you know, what was their emotional response to this, so that, you know, the kind of the ultimate message of immortality, of like, you know, what is Marissa Marcel's take on this, I think very much feels like that was a joint effort, and you know, came from some places that were very real. But I think ultimately the thing that is exciting is connection. I think like a human connection, and you know, it might be that you meet a person in real life and have a connection and share something of your life and absorb something of theirs. And ultimately, whether you're writing a book or making a movie, you're kind of trying to do the same thing. And we have this magical ability through technology to do it with lots of people at the same time. And what I love about video games is that some of that interaction is not necessarily, it's not real interaction, but like there is some of that dynamism is kind of retained in the work, so that when people are playing Immortality and having an intimate reaction to it and feeling like they've had a very personal experience, you know, that's different in the way that it would be with other pieces of art. So, you know, I think trying to find ways to create that. And that's really why I have found myself, I think, in this FMV world, is like the stories I want to tell and the connections I want to create with players, so much of that is accessible through human faces and human performances. You know, it's, I wouldn't even say it's a shortcut. I feel like it's just a powerful tool to be able to kind of create those reactions and experiences for people.
We really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to talk to us.
I enjoyed it. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me. After, you know, you make these things for 3 years, and it's exciting to get to go and talk to people about them, and you know, not be secretive, or you know, and just know that it's out there and people have interesting questions to ask about it.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, Sam. We really appreciate you for coming on. And that was our conversation with Sam Barlow about his new game, Immortality, as well as just like all of these games he's been making with Half Mermaid Productions that are focused around like these searching and scouring archives in order to, for the most part, like solve a mystery. Yeah, Ben, I feel like this was a challenging conversation, I think, in some ways, because his games are so different from basically anything else we've played for the show. But I feel almost like my whole idea of like what a game could be really changed after talking with him, and that was really cool.
Yeah, and I, you know, I think like if you're someone who is like interested as in, again, I think this is a very tired conversation in a lot of ways, but games as art, like Sam Barlow is your fucking guy, you know, like, yeah. Sam Barlow is like very interested in like what is art and how do we make, you know, games be a way of engaging with, you know, narrative and story that is absolutely about like how do we you know, ask these bigger, deeper questions. And so I think it was like definitely a conversation that was hard to get our arms around at times, because Sam's very smart and also is like interested in, you know, engaging with these things in a really complicated way, which is great and good, but also hard sometimes as an interviewer when you're just like, well, wait a minute. Like, wait, are you saying that, that scrolling through Wikipedia is like a game? Like, what's going on here? But it was great.
Yeah, and I feel like another thing, I don't know why this comes up in so many of our episodes, and maybe it just revolves around like both of us being writers and kind of interested in narrative and interactive narrative. But I feel like no matter what, any kind of narrative-based game that we play and talk about, the ultimate kind of question that comes up revolves around like visual novels and like thinking about interactive fiction and in the sense of like traditional game design. And yeah, there's like a moment in this conversation where we're talking about all those things, like what a game means to Sam, like how does he view immortality, you know, thinking about player agency. And it just really got, and I think he might have even said something about like choose your own adventure novels. And like, I don't know, there's like a moment when during that conversation and he was talking about like choose your own adventure and like his start into text-based like role-playing games when he first started out developing games, where I was just like almost having an out-of-body experience just thinking about like choose your own adventure games and like creative nonfiction and like collage essays and like how in some ways like that is kind of like a game, that interactivity that you have when you're kind of putting the pieces together in this non-linear narrative, how there is a lot of like game-like qualities, and in some ways he's playing with that from like a visual standpoint.
Yeah, I think it like it gets to, you know, one of the things that I think Sam is interested in is like if we can interact with a text, right? Like, what does that mean? And what does that add that, you know, watching a movie or reading a book that are in some ways static can't really engage with you as a person playing, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think he's really interested in like, how does that further what he's doing? How does that further a narrative? You know, how does that complicate a story if the text is in some ways like changing to the person playing it, but also is like in a creepy way, like pretty explicitly, as with Immortality, aware of the player playing it.
Yeah, 100%. And I feel like, you know, you had played Her Story, I had played Immortality, and you know, it's interesting. I think I don't think we get too much into it, but you know, I kind of left it playing Immortality feeling like I don't know if it's really the genre for me necessarily, like what he's doing, but I feel like it's like almost there. And I think the way that you described Her Story is almost being, it's like more like you enter a word, a keyword, and that brings up different clips. That seemed like something that was a bit more easy to parse than something like Immortality, which in a lot of senses is really asking a lot of the player in terms of understanding like all these different narrative layers that are you know, sandwiched on top of each other, on top of like navigating a UI that I, in my opinion, isn't like super intuitive. That it's just interesting to kind of see like between these three games how he's found new ways of iterating and like remixing the gameplay, that I'm still intrigued by it, but like I don't know, at least like the way that that Immortality was delivered, I'm like, damn, maybe I'm just like stupid. I don't know, like it was like a really tough game to parse for me, you know.
Yeah, no, it definitely felt like, and again, I definitely felt this while playing Her Story too. I ended up like halfway through, I was like, I need to take notes. Like, I need to write down what my thoughts are in order to like figure out what next to engage with and figure out like what's a keyword just so I don't forget it that someone says is in a scene that I want to follow to next. And so I think it definitely, you know, these are games that are not made for kind of passive engagement, like I think many games are. These are games that really are like, we want you to be thinking about like eight different layers and eight different levels all at the same time. Yeah, so I also was feeling, am I too dumb for this?
I mean, I had probably put in like, let's say 4 hours, and I was like looking up on Reddit, like literally like how to play Immortality, having already spent 4 hours with it. And I did that like multiple times. And, you know, if anything, I mean, I think if I'm being like more objective about it, it really shows this kind of like the power of what Sam's doing in terms of like expanding what the medium can be, where like somebody like me has been playing games all my life has to be like, oh, like what actually am I doing? And like it almost feels like you found this alien artifact, you know, and you have to like kind of retrain your brain to understand, you know, how to engage with the thing. So if anything, I think like that's really cool and really, really valuable and something that the industry really needs, given the fact that so much of the industry now is like rehashing the same three ideas.
The three same games over and over and over. There's one more thing I'm going to make us talk about because it definitely stood out to me, which is the game itself is kind of asking this question about art and like, is it worth it to kind of suffer for your art if that art kind of preserves you and your works into immortality, right? Like in the same way that a movie might or a book might. Like, what does it mean? You know, is it worth it if there's suffering and abuse that goes into the creation of the thing, if the thing at least allows you to kind of have touch on some kind of immortality? And when we kind of asked Sam about it, he said this thing: games are imperfect immortality machines. just kind of the idea that, you know, they're degrading so quickly, just in terms of, you know, so many games they age out very quickly, people stop playing them very quickly. You know, right now I think we're in this moment where there's just so many that it's like they get lost very quickly, and if there aren't physical versions, you know, they can like truly disappear, become unplayable on new machines. And so I don't know, I was just a thing that I was thinking about a lot after that interview is like, well, what is the purpose and the value of all this work that goes into something like immortality? Because immortality, I think, like, you play that game and you're like, holy shit, someone put a lot of effort into this. And what is the value of it when it can disappear like almost instantaneously in like the grand scheme of things?
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good point to end on, because it's just like, yeah, the games as an art form, it's such an interesting space, because like Sam's talking about, so many games that kind of get made, maybe they're talked about for and hailed, and then they're kind of like, so they become so archaic so quickly that it almost becomes like they're just forgotten, you know, like these almost canonical works, unlike, you know, like a novel, which you can kind of, we've figured out how to write novels, you know. In some ways it's kind of like games are still in this space where we're figuring out the language that best exemplifies what the medium is. And because of that, like, there's all these essentially these experiments, and, you know, the longer that they exist, the more it's kind of like, well, why do I want to go to this old experiment? You know, and I think especially since it's a visual medium, that's always going to be the constant battle of like, oh, well, this looks old, or like, this doesn't play like what the new hotness plays like. And I think Sam is really interested in that, right? And in some ways, the games he's making are kind of like future-proofed in that regard, because they use real people and they're using like these mechanisms that are easy to understand.
Yeah, and it's like, I do think it's like, it's a thing that is worth thinking about, especially like if we broaden the scope out when we talk about like art more generally, which is like, you know, what does it mean to create something if it is impermanent? I don't know. I've been thinking about it a lot lately, Phil, because did I tell you this? We watched the like Netflix documentary about Infinity the other day.
No.
And like the conclusion of that in some ways is like everything is going to be ground to dust. Like nothing is permanent. And so like, what does it mean that the effort, you know, and the time and the place and the how much you're kind of putting into things, is it worth it if it's going to be, you know, disappeared? And I don't know. I just think it's an interesting thing to think about, but it does like in some ways answer the question for me of like, well, how much, you know, like how much abuse should you tolerate, or like how much pain should you tolerate in creating the thing, where I'm like, like makes me feel like not that much.
No, I mean, I think that's, yeah. I mean, if you have any idea of how we should think about these issues around like, is it worth it in art, then shit, like, let us know. We'd love to continue that conversation. I think that's kind of like almost the ethos of the whole show, of like, what is this, you know, is this process worth it? And like, how does it affect us when we make these creative works? So, yeah.
I'm fully off the rails. Become a hedonist. Like, that's the end. That's the conclusion of immortality. Thank you.
So, you know, if you want to check out Immortality, it is available on Steam. It's on Xbox Game Pass. I believe it's on PlayStation, and it's coming to Netflix on like their iOS rollout. So definitely check that out. And, you know, Sam's other games have definitely been hailed for years now. So Her Story and Telling Lies are available on all platforms. You can find Sam at Mr. Sam Barlow on Twitter, and you can check out his production company Half Mermaid at halfmermaid.co. Where can they find you, Ben?
They can find me at sad_radio_lad. You can also shoot us an email. Did you say that? At theoriginstorypod@gmail.com. Our website is originstory.show, and you can always tweet at us at originstory_. Thanks, as always, to Melody Hirsch for all of the design work for Origin Story, and to Ryan Hopper for the intro and outro music, which you are likely hearing right now. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I don't know, so we don't disappear forever, never to be thought of, heard of, ever again.
So we're not ground into the dust through infinity. So with that, we will see you all again here on the next episode of Origin Story. Peace.
What's the point?